a lot, Tony, and thanks to all of you. It's lunchtime, so thank you for sticking around. I'll try and make this brief. briefly, I'll quickly run through this. You've heard all this all day, all morning. Phosphorus transport to water is two main forms, dissolved particulate. We can control particulate P by controlling erosion. Dissolved is more difficult. Leaching and lateral losses of phosphorus especially contains a lot of dissolved phosphorus. This is important in golf greens. And as you all know, when soils become saturated with phosphorus, much greater potential for losing dissolved phosphorus in runoff. You've seen this. You all are aware of the notion of the use of phosphorus removal structures. Push a high phosphorus concentrated water through the material, contain it in a structure. Low phosphorus water comes out. Replace the saturated PSMs at some point. Okay, so the objective of this study was to build a structure on an urban watershed, a phosphorus removal structure on an urban watershed. Why an urban watershed? Well, to be honest, I wanted to build one in agricultural, particularly poultry farm. It's very difficult in Oklahoma right now because of the lawsuit. It's very, very tough to get cooperating poultry farmers. They're very nervous about the lawsuit. And what I found as a result is okay, so I turned to golf courses. And actually, they're very, very interested in this technology. Golf courses and also cities for treating stormwater are very interested in this technology, probably more, from what I've seen in Oklahoma, more than agriculture is. So we want to build one of these on an urban watershed and also test the accuracy of a previously constructed model. Some of you may have seen Dustin Stoner's talk on the model that was put together for these things. We want to test to see how well that model will work for predicting the performance and the lifetime of the structure. Here's the structure. We'll get right to it. This structure is shown here, built on a 152-acre watershed. A big percentage of that watershed is undeveloped land. You can see a decent amount of residential property and also, of course, the golf course. And at the point of drainage is where we have our filter. This is, you can see the water is somewhat channeled down through the landscape, comes down across the golf cart path and also through drainage through this culvert to this point into the ditch where it drains in Stillwater Creek. And this is what it looks like now. We have a nice pretty culvert built and the structure. So the water comes into it. It's 2-inch pipes. Evenly, if you can imagine what's buried underneath the surface here, this is, we chose steel slag for this. We knew it would work. And Dr., you know, you see, most of you probably saw Dr. Drizzo's talk. She's done tremendous amount of work on slag. We know it works. So the water is evenly distributed through. If you can imagine underneath the surface of this slag, we have a network of perforated pipe to distribute the water throughout. It infiltrates through the sorption material and drains out downstream. Here we have an overflow weir, similar to the style that Dr. Bryan has used on his structures. In the case of rainfall events, runoff events that are so large that it can't handle it, it can go over. So we monitor the water going over, the flow rates, and also flow rates of the treated water. It was about $1,200 for the cost of the steel and the welder time. Most of that cost was for the welder time. I could have gone out there and welded it myself, but this is on a golf course, and it's got to look really good. So we got a lot of good pipe welders in Oklahoma with the oil industry. The slag was free, sort of. We sieved it. I went with sieved slag because, get that in the next slide. We sieved it. It cost $200 to sieve it. They gouged us basically at the gravel quarry, to be honest with you. $200 to sieve it and then transport it from Fort Smith, Arkansas to Stillwater. About $1,400 total. I mentioned sieving it. We sieved it because for this particular type of slag, electric arc furnace slag, and we have a pilot scale filter, which spent another talk on that, but we can put about 1 ton of materials in it. We've tested a lot of stuff in it. The slag, we found that it clogged in about 3 days, and we had the precipitants would form in it, calcium phosphates, calcium carbonates, calcium silicates. You can see the coloration there. It would actually clog our drainage pipes. So I got a little gun shy. I didn't want to put all this slag out into the structure and have it clog up on me quickly. So I sieved it. I probably sieved a little more than I needed. I sieved it to a quarter inch. I probably didn't need to make it that much, but the conductivity is really good, as you can imagine. But it's probably not necessarily to go that far. How much less you could sieve it, I don't know. All right, so the structure was about eight foot by 10 foot. The footprint about 8 inches deep. 3 tons of slag was in it. We finally got the slag put in on July 12th last summer. And the golf course, and we weren't aware of this, the day after we installed it, we go out there to look at it, and with our automatic samplers, we had samples already. It didn't rain. Well, they irrigate in the summertime there pretty much daily, and they irrigate a lot. Every night, almost every night, unless there had been recent rainfall, we got samples. As I mentioned, automatic samplers, we're monitoring everything coming through this thing, monitor the outflow rate, and if there's ever an overflow rate over the weir, we're able to monitor that rate as well. We haven't had it yet. We've had an inch and a half rainfall event, a couple of those, 2-inch rainfall event. Nothing has yet crested the weir. That conductivity that is so high since we sieved it to a quarter inch, it's been able to handle everything. We're also monitoring the inflow and the outflow concentrations with the automatic samplers. As Dustin mentioned in his talk, retention time is very important to the design of these structures and how effective they can be. Our aim in this is to have small filters, small footprints, so you need to have a very short retention time. That's our goal with this. We used a dye, Rotamine WT tracer test, to assess the retention time. How long does it take for the water to move through this thing? The inflow concentrations were input into a one-dimension convective dispersion equation, and from that we're able to estimate the retention time, average retention time for this structure to be about 9.3 minutes. Here's some results. This example event, this is rainfall event. This was actually a tropical depression that moved through in September. Over the course of about 2 days, we got about 2 inches of rain, and you can see the different at different times when the rainfall came. On the hydrograph here, flow rate in liters per minute, it handled all the flow. We've seen flow rates, it's handled up to, gallons per minute, sorry to go back and forth between units, but in gallons per minute, 180 it's been able to handle, no problem. Here we see phosphorus concentrations corresponding to the right-hand axis. The inflow going into this filter is typically around 0.5 parts per million. A lot of rainfall events. With rainfall events, it often gets up to 1 or 1.2 parts per million. With the irrigation events, it's usually more around 0.5 or even just 0.3 parts per million. But still, that's a pretty good load coming down the pipe. In this event, we were able to remove 36% of all the phosphorus. Again, we're able to treat all the water. Nothing crested over the weir. Here's a typical irrigation event. In the beginning with all the irrigation events, you know, we were removing 100% of it. Here's one where, you know, with later time, 88%. This was a typical one. Again, the flow rates from that were much, much less. Concentrations around 0.5 part per million. We are removing most of it. Okay. The model that Dustin's been working on. The model, using the design curve, is the solid line. We see the prediction of the amount of phosphorus removed with phosphorus added. And the squares show what we've actually measured based on how much has been added through runoff coming into that filter and how much has been removed. So you can see, so far, we're doing pretty good with the model. I can tell you right now, based on the pilot scale filter, that the model is slightly overestimating reality. I can tell you right now, I'm guessing at least that it's probably going to end up around here, based on what I've seen on the pilot scale filter. But the model predicts overall 31% cumulative removal at the point of saturation. When that material is saturated with phosphorus and ready to be removed, it will have removed 31% of everything that's been put into it at that point. And it predicts, based on the hydrology of that watershed, if the loading into this filter over the past few months will continue similar patterns over the next several months in the future. We predict it will last 15 to 24 months. Again, we're going for small footprint filters here. So now our goal is to, we want to get this technology adopted. It has a strong potential application TMDL programs for total maximum daily loading, because now we have a tool where we can predict and measure how much phosphorus will be removed. I say predict through the model, and when I say measure, I mean at the end of the day, you want to know how much your filter is removed. You pull a sample of the materials, measure total phosphorus on it before and after it's been exposed in the filter. You know how much has been removed. You have an absolute number of how much phosphorus how much you've trapped in the landscape. Could be very valuable for TMDL programs and nutrient trading. I'm very interested in selling this idea to the NRCS. I'd really like to see it cost shared in the EQIP program. And at the end of the day, what we'd like to give them is the model or software where that they can use based on using any material, a model, not just for slag, but any possible material where you measure a few basic parameters and then essentially predict how big your filter needs to be for a certain site, or conversely, if you have a set filter, a cookie cutter filter you're just going to put in, how long will it last, how much will it remove, depending on what material you have, the retention time, the phosphorus characteristics and the flow of that watershed, etc. We've also developed a rejuvenation process for that slag, for that quarter inch size slag, a rejuvenation process in situ where we're able to coat it with aluminum oxide. So basically, once this is spent, once it's saturated, we're going to rejuvenate it. And if it's anything like the pilot scale filter we have, which contained about a ton of material, it will last just as long as the original material. And that's it. Finished under. You can go to lunch. Thank you very much. Dr. Drizzo.
Thank you very much for the really excellent presentation. And I'm really delighted with your optimism, because I work in this field for 15 years and I still have difficulties to get full scale applications. So best of luck with that.
It's very difficult.
Did anybody ask you about chromium? Well, first of all, one remark regarding your screening to 1/4 inch. Actually, electric arc furnace slag is really not interested to steel slag producers in the United States at all, because they're mini mills. They're mainly interested in blast furnace and basic oxygen slag. So this is the reason why you couldn't find it pre-screened, because people don't care. And of course that you will have all this coagulation and clogging in
yes.
your green material. So the size of those is quite alright.
So you think the blast, we would have less problems with that if we use blast furnace slag, we wouldn't have to sieve?
You can find it sieved, yes.
You can find it sieved.
Other sources.
That's excellent.
Then the other thing is, you will have to check your chromium levels. You will never get any, you know, anywhere further than in your experiment.
That's a question I get a lot. We have measured it. We so far in the filter.
Not enough in one experiment. I mean, I have data from like over past 5 years, and they're still asking me for more data.
Yes.
I mean, that's why I had to go to Taiwan to get technology validated there. So now they're wanting to do it in the States. And I'm quite surprised that for 3 tons of electric arc furnace steel slag, you predict only 24 months life expectancy.
Well, you know, you sieve it out to that size. That quarter inch size slag doesn't do anything. It doesn't remove even a drop of phosphorus compared to the full size fraction, like what you've done in a lot of your work.
6 millimeters. I work a lot with 5 to 14 millimeters.
And we could probably use that and still have a good connectivity. Like I said, I was gun shy and I wanted to get something out there for a demonstration. It's mostly to show for demonstration. But next time, I would definitely like to use something a smaller particle size. Definitely. Thank you.
You can talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, sir.
Would there be any benefit, or is it at all practical, to have a gradient of sizes so that it gets larger things first and then? I don't know if there's a benefit.
You know, if you can push it through, if you can push it through and still be able to treat the same amount of water, that would be great. But my only concern would be once you put in a smaller size fraction, you're limited based on that, the hydraulic clemency of that one layer right there. You know, some people, like Ray has had the idea. He suggested, how about two filters in sequence, you know, possibly. And that's...
Take one.
Yeah.
Well, I showed that for my paper, in my published work.
In sequence. Dr. Moore.
Have you tried to calculate the cost per pound of phosphorus trap?
Yeah, I have. I have actually, and I meant to have that written down in the back of my hand when I come up here. And I'm not even going to try and remember what it is because I'll probably get it wrong. But not only that, the thing is this: what do we have to compare that to? I'm not sure what other practice we can compare it to.
Well, for example, stone water retention pond in the golf course, it costs a fortune to build one and it doesn't remove phosphorus. So, you know, you put your transfer, the cost of material, and you compare.
You bring up a good point. I mentioned the biggest things now is trying to get NRCS and other groups to adapt this, but to get them to do it, not only do you need to be able to model it, but you're exactly right. We need to show the cost. We need to be able to show the cost, especially compared to other practices like what you just mentioned.
All BMPs, we need to develop a sheet that's like cost per pound, you know, of phosphorus held. Whether it's fencing, buffer strips, everything. And as scientists, we always blow that part off.
Yes.
You know, because
yeah, it's so hard.
And get those so yeah. The NRCS guys can get, you know, go down there and pick the technology that gives the biggest bang for the buck.
Yeah, and that's what they want to see. That's exactly what they want to see.
I just have one brief question for you. When you speak about phosphorus model and you just plot like amount of phosphorus added versus retained, we have been publishing like models like that since early 2000.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know why you call it like a model. That's question number one. And the other one is like if you put actually the same like, you know, y-axis and x-axis, the same scale, you will see better that line when you have like 100% efficiency and, you know, the graph looks much better. I don't know why I call it model.
I guess the reason I call it the model is this okay? Is it still there?
There is a lot of published work when we present data in the same way, and you know, coming from civil engineering, and then people who work like in early 90s on phosphorus
right.
materials. So I don't see what you know. It seems like some new model, but it's actually thing that has been used for.
Right. I generically call it a model because it's just from the perspective that you're trying to predict something. I mean, we could call the Langmuir sorption isotherm a model, and this one particularly, this is what from what Dustin has developed, where this in this particular I'll call it a model here. You input the retention time and the phosphorus concentrations being input into it to produce that line that this. This prediction line. So I call it a model because we are predicting the unknown, I guess, for lack of a better way to describe it.
Okay, if you want, if you want a reference, I'll direct you to a website where we've got all these, you know, BMPs already costed and, you know,
yeah. Oh, excellent. I'd love to.
We need to do this for a real purposes.
yeah. I'd love to. Excellent.
One more question than you.
From LA presence perspective, I noticed that by dusting in his top, in his lab, everything was very clean, and he was trying to predict this model based upon a clean system rather than the water. Dissolving the phosphorus.
Actually, he was using a simulated ditch water.
Okay.
Yeah, he made a ditch water to represent what Ray had. In his, so it wasn't just DI water.
Okay, so you have taken into account other things that would have caused flotation in bruises.
Yes, it's a good question. Because if we had done it with just DI water and nothing else, we would probably get very different results. That's a good point.
All right. Thanks, Jared.